you followed up with me later, and I just really appreciate it. No one else did that. And I've always wanted to say thank you. And I was like, yeah, no problem. And he said, wait, do you mind sending me two books? And I said, yeah, absolutely. Who's the other one for? And he said, oh, it's for a friend of mine. I'm like, oh, who's that? And he said, Chris Pratt. And I was like, oh, that's interesting, because I thought of Chris Pratt playing this role as I was writing it. So Jared read it first just to make sure it wasn't garbage. Then he gave it to Chris Pratt and said, here's your next project. And Chris read it and called me a week later and wanted to option it.
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and big treat today. Really cool fucking guest. We're pumped to have him. A lot of you are very familiar with who he is, what he's done. I will let him go into some of his literary work and life history, but none other than Jack Carr. And I don't want to just quote the Terminalist, because you have so many books that you've written, and I guess The Terminalist is probably the most well-known one because of the TV show, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's who he is, man. I appreciate you being here, brother, and taking the time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on. I'm fired up. Yeah, sixth book comes out May 16th, Only the Dead. So it's been a busy few years since I got out of the military, but I feel extremely fortunate that these books have resonated, particularly with law enforcement and military. Like, this was all grassroots, because today, your publisher is going to, they have limited resources, probably like law enforcement, definitely like military. You have to allocate those resources accordingly. And so who's probably going to get most of the attention and advertising budgets and all that stuff from a major publisher are those people who have proven to deliver, people with last names like Patterson, like King, like Grisham, because they're essentially like Marvel movies paying for all the other movies out there that don't make a return. So this was all grassroots. This was one person reading it and going into that fire station, going into that police precinct, going into their team in the military and saying, hey, have you checked out this book? And them telling a friend and them telling a friend, and it's spreading like that. So that's really what. So I'm so thankful to everybody who took a risk on me with their time, which they're never getting back, because I was a brand new author that was not coming from politics, not coming from sports, not coming from having an influencer type of a background on social media. Had zero social media, and taking a risk on me and then telling a friend about it. So I'll thank everybody who's listening out there that walked into that police station or fire station and told the rest of the guys about it. It's sincerely appreciated.
That's awesome, dude. So tell us about, I guess, the starting at your military career. How did you end up wanting to go into the SEAL teams?
Yeah, I was lucky. I found out what the SEAL teams were very early in life. And I think it was just in my DNA to serve. I can't remember ever wanting to do anything else other than maybe even earlier wanting to be a race car driver like every kid or something like that. But I never gave up on those early dreams. Like people that grow up and that when they're five, they say they want to be a police officer or a firefighter. Well, I found out what SEALs were at age seven. And my grandfather served in World War II. And he was killed off Okinawa in 1945. So I grew up with a match that they gave aviators back then. He was a Marine pilot, flew the Corsair, which for those listening is the one with the gull wings that would fold up on aircraft carriers. And there's a show on TV back then called Black Sheep Squadron that was based on Happy Boynton's autobiography. And they took some liberties, of course, but to a kid growing, I watched it in syndication in the early 80s with my dad. And that was really his touch point and my touch point, his father, my grandfather, because he never even met his dad. His dad left for the war and then he was born. So he never got to meet his dad. But we had that touch point and I just knew I was going to serve. I had his medals. I had his aviator wings, had pictures of him and his squadron, him with his plane. So I knew I serve in the military. That was just a natural thing for me to do. And then found out what SEALs were at age seven. And was also lucky that my mom was and still is a librarian. So when I asked my dad what SEALs were, he pretty much said, ask your mother. And so we went down to the local library and did a bunch of research. And the early 80s, you could read about everything that was written about SEALs back then. Special operations, even lots of it was about Vietnam, magazine articles, newspaper articles, a chapter here or there in a book. But people didn't really know much about SEALs back then. So essentially read most of it. And then about age 10, for sure by age 11, for sure by sixth grade, I was reading the same books that my parents were reading. So I was reading things by Tom Clancy, David Morrell, Nelson DeMille, A.J. Quinnell, J.C. Pollock, Mark Old, all these guys in the 80s who had protagonists with backgrounds that I wanted in real life one day. Because in the 80s, for those who didn't read, if you remember TV shows, movies, the protagonist usually had a background in Vietnam. In these type of thrillers, these type of action movies, they were either SEALs in Vietnam, they were special forces in Vietnam, they were Marine snipers in Vietnam, they were CIA paramilitary guys in Vietnam. And now in the 80s, they were private investigators, or they were working for the CIA, or they were police officers, or that's kind of their background. And so I gravitated to those types of books and had so much fun reading those books. There was just magic in those pages for me. So I knew that after my time in the military, then I'd read those same types of novels. And what I didn't realize was that I was giving myself an early education in the art of storytelling by reading all those masters back then. And then by watching movies that were adapted from these books, or TV shows adapted from these books. And so I was giving myself that education, and hadn't built up any filters yet, because I'm watching these things, reading these things at age 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, and I hadn't yet built up any biases, any the cynicism that comes with age. So I didn't wake up one day in the SEAL teams and say, hey, I think I'm going to give this writing thing a try. What should I have been reading for the last 30 years? I'd already built all that. I built that foundation by reading both fiction and the nonfiction, studying warfare. So when it came time to sit down and write, I have this background in the art of storytelling by being a fan of the genre. I read all this nonfiction, of course, on warfare, particularly insurgencies and counterinsurgencies and terrorism. And now I have this experience downrange in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I can bring the feelings and emotions behind doing these certain things to the pages of a completely fictional narrative. So all of that came together at the right time and place. And I started writing during my last year in the military and sent it off to Simon & Schuster as soon as I got out.
That's fucking awesome, dude. It's very interesting. I don't think you run into many Navy SEALs that have a literary background like you do. Mother's a librarian, and then your grandfather was killed in action. God rest his soul. Thank God for a guy like your grandfather to show up and do the job that needed to get done. What'd your dad do?
So he was an attorney and then got into real estate after that. I just grew up. I think I really credit my parents for it's never setting limits, meaning they didn't really tell me I couldn't do anything. They never told me how hard, they would tell me how hard things were, but I just let that, I was just kind of fuel. So I really credit them, especially the encouragement to read. And that was like a normal part of our life. It wasn't something that they had to force us to do as kids. It was just as normal as sitting down to eat dinner or to go on a hike or whatever else. Like, reading was a part of my life from the very early age. I don't really remember a time when it wasn't, but it wasn't something that was like abnormal. Like today with our kids, I find you're competing with so many more distractions, those devices, those games, that Oculus, like all these things you're competing. And back then, you had the Atari 2600 for those who grew up in the 80s and remember that, but you could only play that for a certain amount of time. I mean, you're going to spend days playing Atari 2600. And after that, you get outside or you would read. And so it was very natural, just as natural as doing anything else. And I just really enjoyed it from an early age, but it wasn't, I think it was because it wasn't pushed upon us that it was just natural. So it's just what we do. This is the time to read, and we will read. So I really credit them with providing me with this foundation by making reading a natural part of life.
What was the game that we all played on Atari? And I hate to sound like,
I'm gonna get it back. Now they have the whole Atari thing. Have you seen it? You can get it like just in the joystick, and somehow it links to your TV, or you plug it in and you can play like all those games through the one joystick.
What was the one with the, where you
combat? Like, remember you combat with the tanks?
No, yeah, I remember that one. But remember the one where you would swing through the jungle? It'd be like alligators trying to bite you and shit. What the fuck was that one?
Oh, yeah, that was the best one. And I'm forgetting the name of it right now. But that, I don't think that came out in the initial like group of games that were available. Like Space Invaders was there, I think. And there was a combat, and there were a few others, but that one was like a second batch maybe of games that came out that was a little more high tech, where you run and you jump over like the quicksand of water or something like that, and then swing. Pitfall. That's it. Fantastic. I mean, that was the game. That was probably the one that we could play longer than any of the others. I think there was Frogger on there eventually, maybe in that second group that came out. But I mean,
Donkey Kong too. I think Donkey Kong was on there, wasn't it?
Was on there, I think, eventually. But yeah, so you couldn't really play those all day. Whereas today, gosh, the games today, they just get them addicted to those phones early on, and it is tough to compete with, as a parent.
I will say this past weekend, I contributed to more of that bullshit, because in our playroom at my house, I took down one 65-inch TV that they use for one play system, and I put up three 55-inch TVs so multiple people could play at the same time, because I got sick of hearing who was fighting over what system and playing Fortnite on split screen. So now we have three systems on three TVs in the room. And I got to be honest with you, it's fucking amazing, dude.
Really?
And I don't want to encourage it more, but like, I can't help but be a giant child, and the whole world knows that I am literally, I tell people all the time, they go, why do you have all this stupid shit? I'm like, well, this is what happens when you have no childhood, and then you become an adult with a little bit of money, and you just start buying the dumbest shit, like Zorb balls. And dude, I've talked about this before in the podcast. I have a 120-foot slip and slide that's inflatable with a splash pool at the bottom. I have it on a trailer. I got to take my quad and trail it out to the top of my hill, and then I have to set it up. And it blows like a carnival fucking blower in this thing. And it's fantastic, dude. It's the best money I've ever spent in my life. I had it built in China.
Hope my kids don't listen to this, because they'll be asking for one as soon as this is over. To use once and then back to the games, probably. That's just how it goes, but yeah, no, we don't have not that set up, the TV and the Oculus and that sort of thing. But it's a distraction, which actually translates over to adults too, because now let's say you came up as an author in the 70s, 80s, mid 90s, early 2000s, there are less things that you're competing with. You're competing with television, you're competing with radio. Let's say it's 1985, you're competing with movies out there. So those are three things, other books. Okay. Well, now guess what you're competing with today? You're competing with all the streaming services, every app, all the podcasts, you're competing with all the games, everything that addicts you to your phone. You're competing with Instagram, you're competing with Facebook, you're competing with TikTok for time. And it's different. It's different for sure. Different battle space than it was in 1985, 1995, 2000. You have to adapt. And that's really what we did on the battlefield in military, was adapt, because the enemy is doing it to you and you're doing it to them. And typically who adapts faster is the one that comes up on top. You're looking to capitalize on momentum, look for gaps in the enemy's defenses. So all those same things I just did looking at the publishing industry and adapted accordingly. And I think it helped that I didn't come from a background in marketing or a background in anything that really translated over, because I couldn't say, oh, you know what I did when I worked at what we did at Google is this, or you know what I did at my last startup was this, or here's what I learned with my marketing degree is that you have to do this. I had none of that. So it's just looking at things, applying a little bit of common sense, adapting, and giving people something of value. So whether it's a post on Instagram or a blog on my website or a guest on my podcast or whatever it might be, it's all about adding value to someone's life. And as much thought goes into any Instagram sentence as goes into a sentence in the book, because I know people are trusting me with that time that they're never going to get back. And that's something that I take extremely seriously. So at its base, the product has to be the best that it can possibly be. And in my case, that's the book or the books now. But if you're not an author, it's just whatever your product is, whether it's this podcast or it's your widget, whatever that thing is, that has to be the best it can possibly be. And once it's the best it can possibly be, people have to know it's there. And one way to connect with people is to add value in ways that don't directly add anything to your life, but makes a connection with, in my case, that readership or that audience, because now people want to know who's behind that product. It's just more natural for them to have that connection. And for me, that's the book. So I try to add value throughout the year to people through everything that I do. And then when the book comes out, maybe they get it and tell a friend. And that's just how it goes.
So you go through a career as a Navy SEAL, and then you say, you know what? This bug has been, you know, I've got to scratch this itch. I want to be an author. When did you actually start taking pen to paper or pencil to paper or fingertips to keyboard and say, all right, fuck it. Like, now I'm going to sit down and start knocking this shit out. What was that moment like? And where did you first sit down and start that shit?
Yep. So right in my little office off our bedroom in Coronado, California, in the house that we rented when I was in the SEAL teams. And for people who've been in the military, you know that when you decide to get out, you drop your papers and essentially you go in a separate pile. So now they know that you are not staying on this track to go be a command CO sometime. So then you have to go to this staff job here and this thing here and this thing here to kind of build your resume to get to that position. You go in the separate deck up, he's out of that pile and he's in the pile that's getting out. So now your job essentially becomes to get out of this gigantic bureaucracy that you've been a part of for 20 years. So you're getting read out of secret programs, you're turning in gear, you're standing in line for medical and dental to make your appointment to then come back again later to go to that appointment and then do your follow-up and all these different things that you have to off, go to transition classes that are useless, or they were for me anyway, and just do all these things that are a complete time suck and are not very efficient. But guess what? It gave me time to write. So I started writing during that last year and a half, right after I dropped my paper. And luckily I had done all that reading growing up. So I was about as prepared as you could possibly be. And of course, I read On Writing by Stephen King, The Successful Novelist by David Morrell, just a couple books like that. Because today you can essentially study how to do something forever and never actually execute because there is so much information out there about how to do something. So I didn't really study how to do it. On Writing, for those who read it, by Stephen King, is more of an autobiography than like a how-to guide. I like that. I like autobiographies from authors, from people who I've read growing up. Frederick Forsyth has one. Actually, I have it right over here. Yeah. This came out a lot after, you know, way after I started writing, but I love reading those kind of books rather than a how-to book. And so anyway, I limited how much I was going to study how to do it because I was very aware that you can study how to do something forever and never execute. So I just started writing, and luckily I had read all these books, and I found Joseph Campbell back in 1988 through a series of interviews he did with Bill Moyers on PBS called The Power of Myth. And my mom and I watched that together, and he talked about how the hero's journey and Hero with a Thousand Faces, that's pretty much a seminal work, influenced George Lucas for Star Wars. And so even back then, I was taking those lessons from Joseph Campbell, thinking about them as I read or as I watched a movie and saying, I see what's happening here. I see why this movie is resonating, why this TV show is resonating, why this book is resonating, or this series of books are resonating with a readership. And I didn't do that consciously. It was just something, it was just now a part of me, especially at that early age. It's not something that's analytical. It's just something that you're enjoying. And I enjoyed reading Hero with a Thousand Faces, watching those interviews with Bill Moyers, reading those books that came out of those interviews. It was just part of me, very natural. So when I sat down to write, I didn't really think about anything else. I didn't think about, hey, how do you do this? How do you get a publisher? How do you get an agent? What if this doesn't sell? None of that bandwidth was wasted thinking about that. All my bandwidth went into making the best product that I possibly could. And in fiction, you have to do that. You have to have a finished product before you show it to an agent. With nonfiction, it's different. So you can sell a book if it's done, if you've written one, or a chapter, a first chapter, an outline, an idea. There's plenty of other ways to write nonfiction or to get start down that path. But with fiction, you have to have that first book written. So that's what I did. Sat down, started writing, and I didn't realize how much of a emotional writing experience it was going to be. I thought when I sat down, I'm like, yeah, I've read all these books. I know what I like. I know what I don't like. I have my title. I have my theme. I have my one-page executive summary, which I write for every novel, and then the outline. And then I sat down to write that, turn that outline into a story, into the narrative. And it became readily apparent from that first sentence that this was going to be a much more personal writing experience than I thought of. And that's because I got to bring in the feelings and emotions behind things that I'd done downrange. So instead of having to find someone who was in an ambush somewhere, interview that person, have their answers get filtered through whatever other interviews and research that I'd done, other movies that I'd seen, other books that I'd read, well, I could just go back and think about how it felt to be in an ambush in Baghdad in 2006, and then apply that to a completely fictional narrative, to my protagonist getting ambushed on the streets of Los Angeles. But those feelings and emotions are real. And I think that's what stood out to Simon and Schuster, and what's really stood out to readers, is the emotion that I been to the novels, because it all comes from a real place.
Were the wheels turning while you were in combat? Like, all right, this is, you know, obviously very fucked up, but you know, as this is happening, like, man, if I'm gonna survive through this thing, one day I'm gonna get this shit on paper, and I got so many good ideas. And like, did that help you really experience what it was like to be in combat, taking mental check marks of how I'm gonna dictate this later on in literature?
Nope. I was fully dedicated to being the best operator and the best leader I could possibly be in the SEAL teams. The fiction that I read, which I continued to read through the 90s, through my all my time in the military, was like a break, a respite from reading all the nonfiction on warfare, doing all the study I was doing on lessons learned from people who had been downrange already in these areas, how the enemy had changed over the last few deployments, that sort of a thing. So I was always just fully committed to being, just like I am now, to being the best author I can possibly be. I was committed to being the best leader and the best operator that I could possibly be. Not knowing that one day I would take these emotions and apply them to fictional narrative, not wanting to go the path of writing nonfiction. Guys have done so much more than I've ever done in the military that I've written about. And many guys who haven't written about their experiences that have done a ton more than I could ever hope to have done in the military. So I never really wanted to go that route, like the Richard Marcinko route, first the nonfiction and then the fiction. That wasn't my path. I wanted to come out of the gate with fiction and with the same kind of stories that I was reading growing up. So as I was downrange in these situations, I didn't think about, oh, this is going to pay off later, or, you know, I can use this later. There was none of that. Not until really I sat down and started turning the outline into the narrative. And that's when I realized, oh, that's those feelings and emotions behind those different events, like what it was like to press the trigger as a sniper. I'm going to be tapping into that, because it's very natural to, and it ended up being very therapeutic also. I think that whatever one's doing, it makes sense to turn, even if, whether it's a positive experience, a negative experience, to build off that foundation, really, because that's your only choice. Eventually you're going to have to get to that point where you build off that foundation, even if it's a negative foundation, because you have to move forward and you have to build upon something. So I sat down to write, and I realized that I had this foundation both from reading and from the personal experience now downrange, and those were coming together as I sat down and transitioning out of the military. So it all came together very natural for me.
So when you start writing, you know, I'm curious to see what you were trying to get out of the writing part of it. And I imagine anytime anybody starts anything, we're all unsure how it's going to go. We just know that we got to give it a go. So when did you realize that you had something there, and when did things start to happen for you?
Yeah, so I never, because I wanted to do this so early, I never really thought that it wasn't going to work out. Kind of like being a so early, I thought, okay, 80% of people make it through, 20% of people make it through this training, 80% don't. That's part of the draw for me to be a deal. Okay, so I'm going to be part of that 20%. But I'm thinking at age 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So I'm just thinking about making it. I'm not thinking about not making it. And everything I'm doing, from sprinting hills near the house to essentially, when I look back on it, it was CrossFit before it was CrossFit. So I'm doing, you know, pull ups out there on a little jungle gym outside. I'm changing up my hand position. I'm climbing up our roof and shooting my bow down at angles and targets, and putting ropes up in the backyard, because I saw in these videos that you could get out of the back of Soldier of Fortune magazine in the early 80s, probably on Betamax. I think they're my mom's attic somewhere still. But I saw SEALs running that obstacle course in sand, and then seeing them climb up a cargo net, and I'm seeing them swing on these ropes. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to do things that kind of look like that as much as I can mimic what I'm seeing them doing. I'm going to do that in my backyard at age 11. And we had, you know, good inspiration for movies like Rocky growing up. You know, that was good, positive influences. But I never really thought that. And so same thing with writing. When I sat down to write, you know, I didn't think about, oh, this, how was the percentage of people that that make it in publish out? It's not very many. How am I ever going to break through? That wasn't even in my mind. I just thought, this, of course, this is going to work out because this is what I want to do. So I didn't waste any bandwidth on that negative side. All that stuff, all that bandwidth went into the novel. And as I'm starting to write, of course, as a child of the 80s, it just made sense to pick my actor and director who's going to star in this thing. As I'm writing my first chapter in this room off our rented house in Coronado, California. So as I started writing, Chris Pratt was the only person I thought of playing this role. And he hadn't been in Guardians of the Galaxy, hadn't been in Jurassic World yet, and risen A-list stardom. He was in Parks and Rec, and he was a, you know, overweight, funny guy. And then I saw his transition into SEAL operator for Zero Dark 30. He had a very small part. And I was like, oh, look at this. This is someone who is inherently likable on screen and off screen. And I see him, he changed his look and his demeanor and everything else, become the SEAL operator. This is the guy that's going to play James Reese, my protagonist. And since I was choosing Chris Pratt already back then, I'm like, well, I pretty much should just choose my director right now. And I thought Antoine Fuqua. I love everything that he's done. He's an amazing director. He's going to direct. And lo and behold, that's who ends up starring and directing all those years later. Not even all those years later. That was like December of 2014 when I started writing. And then we started filming in March of 2021. So that's kind of crazy.
Yeah, tell me about that, dude. How was that transition? Like, all right, hey, we want to make a film out of this. What's that? Like, what was that experience? Were you excited? Tell me about that shit.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. And there's a lot of trust that goes on when you option your book or anything for that matter, because you're handing it over and they can essentially, and if you don't have a, let's say 20 books out already, you're not going to get any creative control. You're turning that thing over and they can do anything they want. They can change the title. They can change everything. And that's just how it goes. So there's a lot of trust involved when you option something. But I got a call from an old SEAL buddy in November of 2017. So about 6-7 months before the book comes out. And we hadn't talked in about 5 years, and calls me and asked me if I remembered him first. And his name is Jared Shaw. And I said, yeah, Jared, of course I remember you. And he said, well, I heard you have a book coming out. And I said, yeah, it's coming out in a few months here. I can send you an early copy, a galley copy, which is like an advanced reader's edition. And he said, yeah, I like that. But I always want to call you and say thank you for what you did from the SEAL teams. And I couldn't even remember what I did for him. And he said, yeah, you're the only person that when I was getting out who sat down in your office, talked to me about transitioning to the private sector. You introduced me to people in the private sector in the area I wanted to get into. You followed up with me later. And I just really appreciate no one else did that. And I've always wanted to say thank you. And I was like, yeah, no problem. And he said, wait, do you mind sending me 2 books? And I said, yeah, absolutely. Who's the other one for? And he said, oh, it's for a friend of mine. I'm like, oh, who's that? And he said, Chris Pratt. And I was like, oh, that's interesting, because I thought of Chris Pratt playing this role as I was writing it. So Jared read it first just to make sure it wasn't garbage. Then he gave it to Chris Pratt and said, here's your next project. And Chris read it and called me a week later and wanted to option it. So that's that was crazy how that came about, because I had no idea I had any connections to Chris, but Antoine. And another buddy gave it to Antoine a little bit after gave it to Jared to give to Chris. So he called about the same time and wanted it. And so they ended up working it out and figuring out their partnership. And we all did it together. So it was a crazy experience, but it could not have been in better hands. And I just crushed it. Antoine's amazing. And now we're off working on a spinoff series right now with Ben Edwards' character, like a prequel, with Taylor Kitsch in the lead role and Chris in a few of the episodes as well. And that will roll into the second season of The Terminalist, which is based on the second novel, True Believer. So it's go time. Things are busy.
Hey, guys, if you're enjoying the Street Cop podcast, do us a favor and give us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you're listening to us. Tell a friend. We don't charge anything for the episodes. We appreciate your support. Check us out on any social platform by putting into the search bar Street Cop Training. Give us a follow. We have a lot of free content coming out every single day that you might not catch here on the podcast. And it's important for you to be able to do your job more professionally, and we also entertain you as well. That's great, dude. And how has that changed your life from a success standpoint? Are you experiencing a lot of different lifestyle changes, more comforts, anything like that?
I don't know. I don't really think about things in those. I never really thought of things in those terms before. I just always did what I wanted to do, and I continue to do that. So the 80 series Land Cruiser out there as my daily driver. But I have a few other Land Cruisers too, so I guess that's changed. But I just go, I just work. It's all about family and working on these projects. So writing these scripts, advising on these scripts, executive producing these things, working on the, that's like the team side of it, because the scripts are so team centric. Very different than writing the novels, which is only me. And that's interesting. I love that there are two different ways to go about it. I love the team aspect over here on this side. And then I love having it be just me on the novels. And I didn't know that was how it was going to be. I thought, oh, this book, it's Simon & Schuster. They want to publish this thing. They're going to want to make all these changes and make it great. Okay, that's fine. They didn't really make any changes. The edits on that first book and all the other books to date, to include this last, Only the Dead, have been like, hey, can you expand on this a little bit here? Can you, I'm not sure he'd say that sort of a thing here, or something along those lines, like very minor content edits. So that's been pretty cool. And I didn't know, because my only vision of an agent was what I've seen on TV. So they always have like the fast talking agent, and they're working with their or the writer, like Californication with David Duchovny or something like that. And so I thought that's kind of what agents did. And they were going to kind of guide you or say, hey, this is what the market's looking for next. And I really wasn't sure how I was going to handle that. But there's been zero of that. My agent doesn't give me any advice. They just do the deal. Publisher hasn't given me any advice or even hinted like, hey, you might want to lay off maybe like the gun stuff or like politics stuff, or hey, do you know what's really working right now is that, none of that, zero. It's been 100% complete creative control on my side of the novel, side of the house, which I love. And I kind of can see why they don't give me any advice from the agent or publisher perspective, because then if it didn't work, I could be upset with them. Like, oh man, I knew I shouldn't have done that. But it's all me. So if it doesn't work, that's okay. It was all on me. There's no one else to blame. And then on the screenwriting side of the house, just by its very nature, there are so many people involved. So it goes, you have writer's room, you have executive producing team, you have a production company in between you and Amazon that gives their notes on thing, and then it goes all the way up the Amazon chain, and then it comes back down with their notes. So you have all these different people involved. So it's really interesting, and I could see you getting frustrated if you thought you were going to somehow maintain creative control as a new author in that space. But for me, I'm just thrilled that they're making it. Have the best team I could possibly have. I'm essentially handpicked with Chris and Antoine. And you have to know and knowing that it's going to change. The book First Blood by David Morrell that came out in 1972, very different than the film that came out with Sylvester Stallone. Both fantastic, but both very different. So I went into it with that attitude that this is going to change. And guess what? That's okay. We're telling a story through a different medium right now. And what was important to me and was important to Chris and Antoine was maintaining those themes and keeping those themes and that authenticity and really exploring the mindset of a warrior, a mindset of someone who's been downrange in special operations over the last 20 years at war, and honoring that person who has made it back. It's sitting on that couch, grabbing a beer, putting their feet and watching a show that's made for them, because we're exploring that mindset. We're not showing these people as victims, or we're just showing a warrior mindset. And that's what we tried to do. And there's always going to be some Hollywood hot sauce in there. So Chris talks about it as being 80%, authentic and 20% Hollywood hot sauce. It's because you're telling a story that has to have a beginning, middle, and an end, and has to get you there in a certain amount of time. So that's just how it goes. Can't really show a deployment where we're sitting around, playing Xbox. Which may have happened for a couple of deployments. We just wanted to honor those people who went downrange. And so that was at the forefront of our mind every single day. So it's an awesome process, and I feel just thrilled to be a part of it. Because a lot of times they like to get rid of the author too. They don't want you on set saying, you ruined my vision. But Chris and Antoine wanted to be involved from the very get-go. So I've been involved with every step of the process and have learned a ton along the way.
What do you admire the most about Chris and Antoine? And the second half of that question is, what do they admire the most about you, do you think?
Oh, I don't know. We'd have to ask them. But you know, I admired them both before I knew them personally. And you can get a sense today of people, especially if they engage on social channels. You get a kind of a sense. It's hard to fake it for years on social channels. I mean, I'm sure people do, but that's got to be exhausting. And Antoine's not really on social channels at all. You know, Chris is, but you can get a sense of people. And so I felt like I had a good idea of who they were before we started working together. But then Chris drove out here to Utah. We spent a week together out here after he optioned it, to the backcountry together, and had just a great time getting to know each other. And he's just a genuine, he's exactly what I wanted in just 2014. And I thought about how important it was to have or portray my character who you would want to sit down and have a beer with, you'd want to sit down and have coffee with, because he's going to do some pretty dark stuff in this book and in this adaptation. So I needed an audience to like him and maybe forgive him for a couple of things. But yeah, I guess what I admire most is that those guys are authentic dudes. They're just good people. And they're people that you'd be proud to call a friend and proud to call if you needed them and proud to show up if they called and needed you. Yeah, just good, solid people is what I'd say.
That's awesome, dude. You know, it's so interesting. The company's grown. There's some notoriety. The podcast has some traction and progress. And, you know, we meet a lot of interesting people and I've befriended a lot of people who are well known. And it's just so interesting to just know that these people are just regular dudes and regular girls. Like they're just regular people who probably are a little more, no, I don't want to say talented because that does an injustice to the hard work and the years they put into trying to master their crafts. But that's it. What separates them is they are unique, I think, as spirits and people. And I think that they put a lot of time, energy, and effort into their craft. And they are just regular people. I spent a lot of time with some people who are like, oh my God, da da da. You know that guy? And I'm like, yeah. Good fucking dude. Right. Like just regular, these are regular dudes. These are just regular dudes. And it's become very natural for me to I don't know, just befriend everybody. It's a very interesting thing. And I don't think I look too far into it other than the maybe a little bit of a surface level, but also more into who they are as a person versus what I think they're about or what they've accomplished. Very interesting. So for you to say that was actually reassuring for me to know that I don't know really any A-listers, that an A-lister that we all, I think, love, Chris Pratt, who's, I think, America's sweetheart in some sense for a man, is a cool fucking dude.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, it's on set. People came up to me and they didn't have to. There's a little thing called Video Village where the executive producers, you have your chair set up and you have your video screen and you're watching, you have your headset on, you're watching the scene go down and all that stuff and making notes or whatever it might be. And the director's there, right off there, off the area right there. So you can talk to him and all that or her. And man, I'll tell you, so many people came up to me and said, hey, you know, my daughter's going to boot camp tomorrow, or my son's going on his first deployment as a Marine. He's a big fan. So I always brought a box of books and I'd have them right there and, you know, sign them and hand them off. And they'd make a point to come up to me and do that. And they would also make a point to say, and they didn't have to do this at all, that they'd been on hundreds of sets, hundreds of productions. And they'd never felt this way on a set before. And that is because of Chris and Antoine. And when I stepped on set, I was like, Antoine is like the commanding officer here at the top. Chris is like that troop commander right here, giving that that tactical level leadership. Antoine's got that strategic level leadership up here. But all of that is filtering down through every single person in that cast and crew and inspiring everyone, because they're showing up with this positive attitude. They're inspiring, they're funny, they're respectful, they mentor everyone along the way, and everybody looks up to them on set. And I can see it being the opposite. I can see how you could have some gosh, how one person it can just turn a set toxic. But you know, we didn't have that. And these people made a point to come up to me and tell me that they've never been on a set and they'd never felt this way before, which is really cool, I thought, because they didn't have to do that. Yeah, looking forward to this next one to continuing the story, especially now that there's nothing to compare this one too, because this first one's a spinoff. And so now we're going back to do prequel origin story. And that means that people who are just comparing it kind of to the book, like, oh, this is different. This is different. This is different. I hate it. Well, there's nothing to compare it to because it's all brand new and we're creating it out of whole cloth and giving these stories and these characters a background. That's pretty cool. And takes this thing more into like the espionage type realm, which is really, really cool. So I think the spinoff is going to crush. I'm super excited about it.
It's awesome, man. You could see it. It's just a wonderful thing to watch you, you know, make this belief, this dream. It's like your baby coming to life. It's impressive, man. And I get it. You know, I'm not an author, but in the same sense, same excitement level, right? We're really seeing some stuff start to impact and have and really hit and really cool shit going on. It's exciting. I'm very happy for you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It's go from the second I wake up to the second I go to bed. And those things that fell off the, you know, the priority list were sleeping, eating right, and exercising, because there's just so much on the plate right now. But I feel extremely fortunate that there are all these projects going on, because it's what, you know, other than being a SEAL, this is what I wanted to do, and wanted to hit the New York Times list. Even as a kid reading these books back in the 80s, you know, you see these names and see it says number one New York Times bestseller, and that's what I wanted, and that's what I, you know, aspired to do, and to have it resonate and to hit number one and all that is and it's all due to people who took a risk on me and spread the word grassroots. So anybody out there that's listening that did that, I sincerely appreciate it.
That's awesome, dude. I have a couple more questions. You experienced writer's block, and how do you feel about writer's block, and what do you think writer's block is?
Yeah, I don't have time for writer's block. I heard Stephen Pressfield talk about this.
Yes.
And I forget if he did it. Now we're friends, which is crazy. You know,
you're friends with Pressfield. Yeah. His book is outrageous. Yeah.
He's amazing. And he has a series of books on creativity. So those are the other ones that I read in the lead up to writing, were his books on creativity. Of course, he has Legend of Bagger Vance. He has The Afghan Campaign. He has Gates of Fire. He has all these amazing, amazing books that he's written. Then he has a series of books on creativity that you can read in a couple hours. I mean, they're pretty, pretty thin, quick reads.
The War of Art. Just so people want to know, The War of Art is a great book. Audio versions available.
Yeah, War of Art is the first one. And then, of course, there's The Authentic Swing, Do the Work, Turning Pro. I heard him, and I think he talked about it. Maybe it was when he was on Rogan. But he said, hey, you don't hear of a trucker getting trucker's block. You don't hear of a dentist getting dentist block. You're a professional. You're a writer. You sit down and write. That's what you do. And I was like, check, roger that. This is what I do. And it was kind of cool after I finished the book. And was already starting on the second one, because I remembered hearing stories of John Grisham, who wrote A Time to Kill first, and he couldn't give that book away. And then he wrote The Firm, and that's the one that just took off, and Tom Cruise stars in the movie. And now we've had a John Grisham book every year, since that first one, since The Firm. And then they republished A Time to Kill after The Firm hit it so big. And I think Time to Kill is his best work. And so I always thought of that, like, what if he just sat back and was like, oh man, this first book didn't hit. I can't give this thing away. I guess I'll just keep practicing law. Well, guess what? He'd just be retiring from private practice right now, or maybe he'd still be working somewhere in a firm. Maybe he'd be a partner somewhere or whatever. But so I thought of that, and I thought of Vince Flynn publishing Term Limits first, and then Emily Bessler, who's my publisher, finding that and giving him a deal with Simon & Schuster. So I thought of that. So I was always going to write the second novel. And then if both didn't hit, I was like, well, maybe I'll reevaluate after that, or do some, you know, go to a secondary or tertiary type of fallback. But I went to Africa to do some research for the second novel. So I'm already writing the second novel, True Believer, flying to Africa, going to Mozambique. The large portion of the second novel takes place in Mozambique. And on the entry form, it asks you occupation. And so I hadn't been published yet. I hadn't even sent the book to Simon and Schuster yet. The first one, I sent it right when I got back from Africa. But I wrote down author. And that was from Stephen Pressfield, from his book Turning Pro, and just his general demeanor in all those books, and his message in all those books, which is you turn pro. It's not a hobby. It's not something you do on the side. You commit and you're a professional. And so I was like, boom, even though I didn't have, hadn't published anything, didn't know anybody in publishing, I just wrote down author. And so I thought that was, I don't know, that just stuck with me for whatever reason. But yeah, Stephen Pressfield talked about writer's block in the sense that, hey, no one else gets it. You're a professional, you write. And so, yeah, no time for writer's block.
No, interestingly enough, I use that a lot. I had some difficult times in my life, and I would come in here and staff would know some of the things that I was dealing with. And I would come in and just literally, you know, never bring anything in my personal life into this building, or go right into a podcast and you know, seem to flow through the podcast or whatever I have to do very seamlessly. And they would say to me, you know, how do you just come in here and never bring anything out on anybody? Or, and I, you know, my response was, I'm a professional. I mean, it's just how I do things. It's time to work. I could be having the worst morning of my life, a very challenging morning, but once I walk through the doors that I'm expected to be professional at, nobody's anticipating me being a worse version of me that day because I have things going on. So, you know, I don't think I'm compartmentalizing things. I think what we do is we say to ourselves, this is who I am, this is how I perform. In some sense, I think we're all maybe a little inauthentic in some point, right? I think we're all true and put our good spirits and our humanity and who we are deep down inside. But if I was authentic right now, I'd be playing Fortnite with my kids. That's what I really want to do, right? But I do love this. You know, you seem like a guy who really, really is positive and a lot of good mindset. And this is a good question, I think, for some people to hear from you is, how do you, with your overall positive attitude towards everything and excitement, how do you deal with adversity and life's challenges when you get punched in the fucking face? How does Jack Carr handle that?
Well, don't let it be a surprise. I mean, that's the first thing. Don't expect it to be a surprise because it's going to happen. You're going to get punched in the face. You're going to go down. Things are going to happen. So don't let those be a surprise to you. And then let's say you have an example of getting knocked down. Well, guess what? You're going to eventually have to get back up. It might take you a little longer, some people than others, whatever, however long it takes you to get back up. Guess what? Eventually you're going to have to, because that's your only option. So now that you've made that decision and that you're starting to stand up, now you get to decide how you're going to get back up. And you can get up moping and whining and talking about how you got dealt a bad hand, or you can get back up and inspire everyone around you, no matter how large or small that circle is, whether it's just a spouse, one person, a spouse and three kids, that's four people. Maybe you have 10,000 people following you on a social channel. Okay, guess what? You can inspire them as well by the way you get back up. So I think it's those two things, knowing that those hits are going to happen, expect them. Don't let them be a surprise. And then when you get back up, guess what? This is where we get to decide how we're going to go through life, and how we're going to get back up is going to inspire or not those around us. But guess what? That falls back on us. And the SEAL teams, I used to talk to my guys about the things that we can control. And sometimes the only thing we have to control is our attitude. And that is a very real possibility. And that attitude can have a direct impact, either positive or negative, on that person to your right and to your left. And this being a team, guess what? You get to choose what kind of a teammate you're going to be. And same thing with family, and same thing in your personal life. We get to decide how we're going to impact those around us, how we're going to influence those around us as we get back up after we get knocked down. Because guess what? It's for sure coming. You're going to get hit and you're going to go down. And guess what? Eventually you got to get back up.
Yeah. Life is not easy at times, and people have to understand that nobody gets a pass at it. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways of looking at it, but certainly being ready for adversity and being ready to know what your game plan is going to be was a really good piece of advice there. All right. Last thing. Sometimes I do this. Sometimes I don't, because I forget, because I have significant ADHD. Significant. I'm actually learning a lot about it to understand how it's perceived from other people to help me better communicate. But one message for law enforcement in 2023, since this is a law enforcement style podcast, even though we have a half a million subscribers and all can't be cops, but what's your message?
And my first one is thank you. Eternal gratitude for continuing to come in every day and put on that uniform and hit those streets and do that job. I can't imagine another time where it is as hard to be a police officer as it is today. So I think about that quite often. I don't know if there's any advice I can give. You know, I'm just thankful that that you're out there. And we had the sheriff came up here not too long ago and got to put the kids in the car and got to go through all the weapons and the gear, the lethal and non-lethal and all the rest of it, and just did a little walk around. And man, all I could think of to do was just to thank him for doing this job, because the time, it is a hard time, I think, to be a police officer. So thanks. And man, stay as safe as you can in probably the most unsafe job in the world. And I thought about you guys a lot, actually, when we were doing ship warnings in the Northern Arabian Gulf, because we would go, and this was to enforce the UN embargo, oil embargo against Iraq before the Iraq war. And you have these tankers leaving Iraq in bad weather and middle of the night. And they just need to make it to Iranian waters because they know that we can't go into Iranian waters, or if we're on board trying to take these ships down and turn them back towards international waters. If we haven't turned them back yet and crossed that line, we have to get off. But you don't know what you're walking up on. You don't know what you're climbing up the side of these ships, and waves are smashing you against the side of the hull, and you're getting on board and you're going up to that door and you're making entry. You don't know what's behind that door. And that's the same thing for every single traffic stop that you guys do. And just walk every single domestic dispute call, and you're walking up towards that house. And I just can't think of a tougher position to be in, because there are so many unknowns and those odds are not stacked in your favor. In the SEAL teams, we try to, you know, choose the time and place of that engagement. Going to and from target is probably the most dangerous part of that, because there's a lot of variables right there. But we've chosen the time, we've chosen the place, we've stacked the odds in our favor with AC-130s overhead and Predator drones and Reapers and whatever other CAS close air support we have on call, with our blocking force, whether we're coming in on helos on the X or we're getting dropped off a little ways out and coming in with an offset type of an infill for surprise, whatever it might be, we're stacking that deck in our favor. You're walking up on that car, up to that house alone with a pistol, and you have maybe an AR, a shotgun back in your vehicle. Man, that is serious business. And so I just want to say thank you to all you guys and gals that go out there and do this every single day and keep doing it. So I know you can't stay safe out there because you're in a dangerous environment, but I'm not sure there's any advice I can give, because you guys are the people that are doing the job. But I just want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart and from my families. Thanks for doing that job.
I think a lot of people in this profession get jaded. They're ingesting things on social media and the news networks. And I try to remind everybody that a far majority of people in this country, and ones that you don't even think have your best interests at stake and have your back and appreciate you, really do. It's the very, 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 very small amount of these people that are anti-police, and we know that they're very small, typically with a keyboard in front of their fingertips, never to your face almost. And, you know, I think they just get beaten up because that's who we deal with over and over again. They have a hard time seeing all the great people in the world that appreciate their service. And I'll just add to this. I joined a mastermind group recently, and, you know, I guess everybody went around the room and they were telling their stories, and I am 1000% the poorest guy there. Not saying I'm a poor person. I'm just saying I am the poorest guy there. There's no question. People are flying in their fucking jets, right? I'm like, Jesus Christ, $70 to park here for the day? Holy shit, right? You know what I mean? Like, so, yeah. So, you know, but I got to tell you, what was weird for me is when they found out what I did in this room of 60 people, everybody came up And they were like, dude, this is fucking amazing. What is it that you guys do? And we're like, hey, we train cops. There's 50 instructors. We're saving lives and all this other shit. And they're like, it's fucking amazing. So I just want everybody to know, if I haven't conveyed that message yet, that all these significantly successful people, and I'm talking about people making 50, 60 million a year, 30 million, 5 million, 100 million, 300 million, a billion, they love the cops, like love them. So don't get it fucked up when you see what you see. I am telling you, I sat in a room with people that you might even cast judgment on because they're so wealthy. And most of them have worked for it, except for one guy. I know he didn't work for it. And they just, they have your interest at heart, and they really appreciate you guys so much. So, you know, Jack, I appreciate you taking the time to, you know, essentially send that message and talk to this community. And the literary work that you do and continue to do is hands down phenomenal and fantastic. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time today to do this podcast and sending your message to men and women.
No, I appreciate that. And I guess there is one thing I would say, just on the training front, because I did so much training before I came in the military in preparation, and I continue to train as much as I can today because I think it's my responsibility as a citizen. But I remember one of those first guys that trained me were Vietnam veterans. One in particular was a police officer, LAPD in the 70s, and after Vietnam. But he talked about like how much ammo was allocated for training, how much training that they got, and how it varied by police department. And I was always like, oh man, if you're not coming from a department that places an emphasis on training and on lessons learned and adapting that training to things that are happening out there in the field, best practices and all the rest of it, you kind of have to do it on your own. You have to kind of take that ownership and realize, oh, I'm only getting what is my qualification that they make me do. And maybe this doesn't seem too difficult. Maybe I should do some training on my own. And I know that's tough to do, especially when you're not making any money. But I think that if you're not getting the training that you need, you kind of have to go out there and do it on your own. And luckily, I think there are some people out there that are offering free or discounted training to law enforcement and that sort of a thing that are out there now. Being the best, for like, I wanted to be the best leader, the best operator I possibly could. And that meant also training on my own, even the SEAL teams. I'd go out there. I'm like, well, we're not doing too much on the shotgun here. We use it for breaching. I want to learn how to fight with it. So I went out there and did training on my own with both the 870 and then with the the autoloading
Benelli
M1 Super 90.
Yeah.
M1 Super 90. Yeah. Batman, one I had made back in the HK shop back in the early 90s, I think, when they're still making them there. So when I did that sort of thing on my own, even sniper sustainment training, I went out there and did that stuff on my own before we had a sniper sustainment training program. And I think that really helped me as an operator, as a leader, because then I could bring, I was spending my own money on it. I went to a driving course with my own money, back at BSR back in West Virginia. But I got to take all those lessons, did make me a better operator. And that's what I always thought that I owed, the guys that I was taking into combat, was to spend every single second I possibly could making myself that best leader, and that best operator I possibly could, whether that's in the gym, whether that's training on my own or reading these books on warfare and insurgency. And counterinsurgencies and lessons learned, so that when I went down range, that I could make the best decisions possible under fire. So for whatever that's worth, it's not saying it's the right way for everybody, but it's the way that I did it.
And things are getting better, and there is a lot of thought, and not only this company but other companies, we do as much as we can for the community. And that's the message we send to people a lot, of like, don't wait to be chosen, choose yourself in a profession that could take your life at any moment. You'd be crazy not to invest $1,000 a year into yourself. And I'll be honest with you, 40% of our class attendees are people that chose themselves and spend their own money to come there. And they have to understand that we're a business. We have to procure revenue if they want this message to get to more people so we can do more things. And we do the best we can to manage the revenue that comes in. And believe me, it's not a selfish thing that we're doing. And I think people know that. So, you know, as strange as the world is at the moment, I believe that we are getting better and better as human beings, contrary to some belief, depends who you ask, overall and in general. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that I think we hold as culture is beginning to shift. And I think there's sort of be some real uncommon sense being brought into it and recognizing that a lot of things on many levels. But where can they find more stuff about Jack Carr and all your novels, and where can we find this stuff? Because I probably pretty much anywhere. I mean, it's not hard. You put Jack Carr into Google, the machine tells you everywhere you can go. But yeah, like, what else did you want to promote?
It's just in case I'm shadow banned at the moment. You never know. Official Jack. JackCarr.com, that's the website, and then you can link to all the socials from there. But the socials are JackCarrUSA, and it's me that I interact as much as I possibly can to say thank you to people for the most part on Instagram and on Twitter, and I think things like repost to Facebook, but like two socials was enough for me. So I think there's a LinkedIn and a Facebook, but I don't engage there. But I engage on Instagram and on Twitter, and that's at JackCarrUSA. So you can do that. And then the podcast is Danger Close Podcast. And that's on the YouTube channel and Apple and Spotify. So that's been a lot of fun as well. Because when I'm so busy, it forces me to read a book that I might have been like, I'm going to get to it later. But oh, I have this guest coming on. I've got to read this book. And then I'll use something from that book in the novel that I'm working on. So it's actually been great on a few different levels. So yeah, they can find me there. And the next book, Only the Dead, comes out on May 16th. So thanks so much. Oh, and as part of that, we were talking about for citizens that are listening to this or watching this, you can help police officers too, just by being an asset to your community, by getting some of that training yourself, to being your own first responder, kind of to hold down the fort until the cavalry arrives. And then by doing these classes, it's so cool to do these classes like with law enforcement next to you. You can talk to them about things that are pretty basic, like, oh, you get pulled over at night. Does it make sense to turn on the light in your car and keep your hands where they can be seen, and like all that sort of thing? It's very helpful, I think, for citizens to train alongside law enforcement and just kind of learn what it's like to be walking up on one of those cars or walking up to a house. And you get more respect for that person doing that. And you get to learn from each other. But I'd say as a citizen, be an asset and be your own first responder, because when you call 911, guess what? It's going to take a little bit of time to get there, and it might help to know how to put on a tourniquet before someone else gets there to do it for you. So little things like that. Learn how to use that fire extinguisher. Make sure you have them in the house. Look around there. Make sure they're not expired. Teach the kids and the babysitter how to put out a little fire, like make a little fire in the backyard or on a camping trip, and the kids can learn how to do it. So the first time they're putting out a fire in real life, or the babysitter's doing it, isn't running around the house when you're not there looking for the fire extinguisher or something like that. So little things like that, where you can make you and your family more of an asset to help law enforcement, to help first responders before they get there in the event of an emergency.
That's awesome, man. Listen, I honestly thank you again. It's been great. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for all you do. And appreciate it. And hopefully we'll meet in person one of these days.
I think that's probably likely. There's a lot of connectivity here and people in between. It's not many degrees of separation, I'm sure of it.
Yep, exactly. Well, thanks again,
Jack Carr. Don't forget me. I say hello to you, like, who the fuck are you? No, I'm the guy. You came my fucking podcast, all right, dude. Don't fucking forget about me, all right?
How could I?
All right, brother. Appreciate you, man. Thank you so much. Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at streetcop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out streetcop.com for that offer.